We might not have been as experienced as the other teams, and we definitely weren't as well equipped, but we were focused. Coach had only three commandments: be in shape, work hard, have fun. They were the perfect fundamentals for a bunch of poor redneck Minnesotans. His motto was, "Pain only hurts." Other teams had bigger squads and nicer uniforms, but we'd show up in our blue jeans and flannel shirts, and by the time I was a junior, we'd kick their asses. Or at least some of their asses. The Cake Eaters at Duluth East were in a different class than everyone else. They wore red Lycra uniforms, and each one of them carried two or three pairs of skis. They were our version of the Evil Empire, or the New York Yankees, or whatever group was rich and powerful and had everything they ever wanted but wanted more. They showed up at meets in privately hired buses. Of course we hated them. I was probably the best skier on our team then, and a lot of it was because of all the endurance and fitness base I had built up running. We did interval training on the skis, racing up hills, and Coach Sorensen told me it was the first time anyone younger than him had ever beaten him. He seemed happy about it. It wasn't just our team that was winning. I started collecting individual prizes that season. My parents would come to the meets, and because they took place in the woods, my dad built a sled. He put my mom in it and wrap her up in a sleeping bag and put big mittens on her hands, and he'd pull her so she could watch me. That felt good. I was ranked 15th best cross-country skier in the state, and my dad had found steady work as a boiler operator at the University of Minnesota Duluth. Even though my mom needed a wheelchair now, and even though I still had to stack wood and do the laundry and cook and clean, I had learned that if sometimes you just do things, well, sometimes things worked out. The trouble was, sometimes they didn't. One day in March, I drove my brother and sister over to our great-grandmother's to take her out for lunch and shopping. When we got home, my mom was lying on the floor. She had fallen when she was trying to get up from the toilet, and she had broken her hip. We called my dad, and we called for an ambulance. My mom never walked after that. My dad changed, too. First, he gave us, especially me, hell. He said he counted on me to take care of things at home when he was working, and I had let him down. I tried to explain that Mom had insisted we go to Grandma's. She said she'd be fine, but he was not having any part of it. He was pissed. Soon, a new physical therapist came to help my mom. The help she needed was now much more intensive. His name was Steve Carlin, and twice a week he worked with my mom on some pretty involved exercises. He saw me watching them, and one day he said, "Hey, you're an athlete. You can help out here. You'd be good at this." That's when I first thought of being a physical therapist instead of a game warden. So, I started being my mom's physical therapist too. I'd always felt close to her, ever since the days she had put my hands around the cookie bowl, and I think my helping meant a lot to her. My brother hated how things were at home, and he spent all of his time skiing and causing trouble with his little buddies. Those were his ways of escaping. My sister kept her head down. My dad withdrew. That summer, I was nominated to go to the Team Berkey Ski Camp for the best high school cross-country skiers in the state. It was held in Cable, Wisconsin, at Telemark Lodge, and all the skiers stayed in a youth hostel in the woods. There were kids from all over the Midwest, and coaches from all over, too. The three-time Olympic medalist, Nikolai Anikin, and his wife, Antonina, were our guest coaches. Antonina spoke almost no English and communicated in yips and yells. She said things with this great accent, like ski-valking instead of ski-walking, like Drago from Rocky IV. We imitated that stuff, and I tried to soak up every Russian-sounding word. I learned about VO2 max, the maximum amount of oxygen we can use for aerobic respiration. I learned about different kinds of waxing and finishing kicks and plyometric strength training and lactic threshold, the point at which our muscles accumulate lactic acid faster than they can clear it. I learned about pacing and how to wear a heart rate monitor to measure how hard I was working. We watched videos of the Norwegians, Swedes, and Finns who were the best skiers in the world, and I was amazed. It was like finding the best book in the world on cross-country skiing. As much as I focused and listened to the instructors, I think I might have learned even more at mealtime. The camp served vegetable lasagna, all kinds of salads, and freshly baked whole wheat bread. At the time, anything more than iceberg lettuce with some cucumbers and creamy ranch dressing seemed bold to me, if not amazingly sophisticated. Whole wheat anything and cooked spinach? That was flat out exotic. I didn't have any choice, so I ate it all, and I couldn't believe how good it tasted. What was even more amazing was how great I felt. I trained more and more often at that camp than I ever had before, and I had never felt better, stronger. I suspected that what I was eating had something to do with how I was feeling, but it wasn't until years later, when I began to study the connection between diet and exercise, nutrition and health, that I learned the importance of diet for everyone, not just athletes. I would learn that a plant-based diet meant more fiber, which sped food through the digestive tract, minimizing the impact of toxins. The same diet also meant more vitamins and minerals, more substances like lycopene, lutein, and beta-carotene, which help protect against chronic disease. And it would mean less refined carbohydrates and trans fats, both implicated in heart disease and other ailments. When I got home, I couldn't stop talking about the camp. My dad built me a slide board out of formica and plywood and 2x4s. I spent hours in the basement on that thing, going back and forth, trying to replicate the skating movements of the Norwegians and Finns. Dad welded me a bicycle, too. He got an old girl's bike and welded a bar across the top. When I wasn't in the basement on the slide board or riding my bike or logging mile after mile running, I was studying the Finnish videotapes and the Swedish books on exercise physiology that I'd managed to get through interlibrary loan. That took some doing. I continued my dietary education, too. The winter of my senior year, I joined my ski team buddy Ben Dineen and his stepdad Ben Croft on a ski trip to Minocqua, Wisconsin. They brought coolers and canvas bags full of whole wheat pasta and spinach salads and black bean chili. We stopped at the house of a friend from Team Berkey Ski Camp named Kurt Wolf, and his mom served us homemade granola. I asked her for the recipe, and when I got home I told my dad I wanted to make granola for everyone, and I showed him the ingredients. He told me to call a cooperative run out of an old house with the name Whole Foods Co-op, no affiliation with the national chain, to see if they had soy flour and wheat germ and barley flakes. I wasn't eating granola and salads because I wanted to make a better world, that would come later, or be nice to cows. I was just noticing that the more I ate what I thought of then as hippie food, the better I felt, and the better I raced. Before high school races, on the morning bus ride, I began to eat a big bowl of brown rice I had made the night before. I hid the rice as I ate it because I knew the grief I'd get if anyone noticed. I tried to educate my family, but slowly. I suspected spinach lasagna might be too much, so I stuck with granola and the occasional brown rice for many months at home. By the time I was a senior, I was ranked 9th in the state. There was only one local kid who was faster. He was not only the best skier around, he was also the best swimmer and bicycle racer. He had already won the regional championship in cross-country running, and was a top competitor at the state meet. That would have been enough. But the word was, he had been expelled from school at least a few times, as well as been thrown off the team for skipping class and mouthing off to coaches. I had first seen him 2 years earlier, when our school bus was going through Duluth. Outside, on a street corner, stood a guy in a bright pink and yellow ski outfit. No school wore those colors, with a yellow ribbon hanging out the back. He carried 3 pairs of skis and had a punk hairdo, with half of his head shaved, the other half in a ponytail. As if he needed to call any more attention to himself, he was yelling and waving for us to stop. It turned out, his coach had left him behind to teach him a lesson because he was such a rebel. He refused to wear his school colors. His uniform was a personal creation. So he had called up Proctor, told him where he would be, and asked if they would pick him up. Coach Sorensen agreed. He always had a weak spot for outsiders. Everyone had a story about this guy. How he never trained, how he would race hungover, all kinds of things. But man, could he ski. I had never seen someone with so much talent. The word around town was he'd never made it past regionals because he was such a screw-up and was always on the verge of flunking out. Report cards came out after regionals, but before state. I remember thinking that if I had his talent, there is no way I'd let my grade slip. When he climbed the stairs of our dinged-up yellow bus, he didn't know any of our names, but we knew his. He was the bad boy legend, the greatest athlete in the state, the juvenile delinquent parents warn their kids to avoid. He was the rogue prince of the cake eaters. His name was Dusty Olson, and he was going to change my life. Stretching. Some people needn't bother with stretching. If you have good biomechanics, don't spend a lot of time in front of the computer, and have the kind of lifestyle where you can nap or take a dip in the ocean whenever you want, you might be one of them. Otherwise, stretch. Focus on the runner's five. Hamstrings, hip flexors, quadriceps, calves, and the iliotibial IT band, or connective tissue that runs from your hip down the outside of your leg. These are the muscle groups that tighten even when people aren't running, from bad posture, sitting, repetitive activities, and just living. Though there are myriad exercises to choose from for each area, I suggest the Wharton Stretch Book for clear instructions and diagrams, what's important is to do them correctly and regularly. For example, to stretch the hamstring, lie flat on your back and loop a belt or a piece of rope around the ball of one foot, holding the ends of the rope in each hand. Keeping your legs straight, lift the roped leg, without pulling on the rope, as high as you can. Keep lifting until you feel a slight stretch in the back of the thigh. Then use the rope to pull until the stretch is slightly, but just slightly, deeper. The stretch should be neither difficult nor painful. Hold for 2 seconds, then relax and lower your leg to the floor. Repeat 5 to 10 times. This exercise uses the active isolated stretching, AIS technique, which I prefer and which is quick. You can do your daily routine in 5 to 10 minutes, easy and effective. Whether you stretch before exercise or after, as I do, using the active isolated technique, there is no excuse not to stretch. Chapter 5. The Pride of the Cake Eaters. Running Around with Dusty, 1992 through 93. A quote from Kurt Cobain. Wanting to be someone else is a waste of the person you are. Dusty's dad spent his days at the bars, and his mom, who worked at the Lutheran church, would give Dusty a quarter and tell him to go play. That was when he was 5 years old. He rode his BMX bike to the Y and spent the day there, swimming, running around, getting into trouble. When Dusty was 12, his dad drove the family car to a bar and never came back. Soon after that, he divorced Dusty's mom and Dusty didn't see his father for years. His mom started dating a guy who hated Dusty and kicked him around. Dusty didn't spend much time at home. I, on the other hand, was either studying, helping my mom around the house, skiing, lifting weights, something I learned about at ski camp, or hanging out with my girlfriend. It seemed that girls liked athletes. Dusty drank. All the kids knew that. We also knew, or thought we knew, that he mouthed off to cops and seduced not just high school girls but barmaids and co-eds. He didn't just beat people in races, but called them names, laughed at them, and insulted their families when he did it. He had no discipline, and he was wasting his prodigious talent. We all knew that. Cake eaters, greasers, and rural rednecks alike. But in the spring of 1992, when Dusty and I were seniors, I learned how much I didn't know. Dusty and I stayed together at the USSA Junior Nationals in Rumford, Maine. There were cross-country skiers from every state where it was a sport. The conditions couldn't have been worse. It was 55 degrees, and the snow was like frozen yogurt. The next day it rained 2 inches, and a cold snap the following night froze the trails into skating rinks. But every day, the coaches would put us through training exercises, and every day, Dusty would talk back. He wanted to know why we were doing this drill or that drill. He wanted to know why we weren't doing more kilometers. He told all of us that the coaches were a joke. He told the coaches they were a joke. I couldn't believe they didn't kick him out on the first day. I had never talked back to an adult. I'd never questioned a coach. He read my face and told me to relax. They were just a bunch of pussies anyway. He called me jerker and dumb Pollock, but the way he said it, I didn't feel insulted. The first day of competition, in a 10K race, Dusty took a really bad fall on an icy hairpin turn with only 2K to go. He took some time getting up, and I knew something was wrong because he was in third place in closing. He calmly announced that he had broken his ankle. The coaches told him to suck it up. No one had broken an ankle. They knew all they needed to know about Dusty. He was just trying to get attention. They told him to get a good night's sleep and to be ready to race the next day. In his room that night, when he took off his boot, his foot was so purple it was almost black. It looked like a black volleyball, but Dusty didn't say anything. There were no wisecracks. I was actually a little disappointed. Maybe the guy wasn't such a badass after all. When he showed up for his start the next day, his ankle was so swollen he couldn't even pull his boot on, but he tried. He didn't say a word, just tried to yank that boot up so he could race. Finally, one of the coaches from another team who happened to be a doctor saw what was going on and yelled at him to stop, that they were driving him to the hospital. Dusty got x-rayed, and sure enough, it was broken. That's when I realized I'd been wrong about Dusty. He was one tough bastard. The rest of the week was vintage Dusty. First, he snuck into the Alaskan team's room and stole their Nintendo game. When they found out, he told them they were pussies and launched a water fight with them that lasted all week. Every night, Dusty would hold forth at the hotel bar over Cokes and ginger ales. He told stories about getting chased through the woods by cops and their canine units. He talked about all the women he'd slept with. He told us about how he had befriended a guy who knew which janitor's closets were open at the University of Minnesota at Duluth, and how he'd steal 90 rolls of toilet paper at a time, then TP the houses of people he wanted to piss off. He said he never ran out of houses. He said he once ran 18 miles from his house to the start of Grandma's Marathon in Duluth, then ran the marathon, then ran the 5 miles home. I said, "Yes, sir," to adults, and Dusty asked coaches, "Why the hell are you making us do this?" I wore button-down shirts, and Dusty shaved half his skull. Our differences were obvious to anyone who was looking. What wasn't so apparent was the hunger we shared. The way we defined ourselves by our effort. When Dusty regaled everyone with outlandish tales of superhuman endurance, they all hooted and hollered, except me. Dusty was hilarious, but everyone thought he was totally full of shit. I wasn't so sure. He had something that allowed him to keep going when everyone else stopped. I wasn't sure what it was, but I wanted it. When graduation rolled around, with some money I'd saved from the dry dock bar, I bought my Grandpa Ed's beige Toyota Corolla so I could drive the 2 miles to work rather than run or ski. I was president of the National Honor Society, and I had read Solzhenitsyn and Thoreau. I was thinking about life beyond Proctor in Duluth and Minnesota, life way beyond our house on the dead-end road, but I couldn't quite see it. I definitely didn't know how I'd get there. I wanted to ski cross-country in college and to study physical therapy. I had become pretty good at helping my mom and had become friends with her physical therapist. Steve Carlin was a real down-to-earth guy, not like the doctor who wanted to put me on blood pressure medicine. Steve would help get my mom up, and when she didn't want to, he would help me motivate her. She had a big wound on her hip from the surgery after her fall, but that didn't scare me. Steve said that was another reason I'd be good at physical therapy. I wasn't squeamish. In my valedictory speech, I said, "I would like to leave you with 4 messages to help you and others benefit from life." I still have the speech. First of all, I ask you to be different. Second, find a way to help others rather than thinking solely of yourself. Third, everyone is capable of achieving. Never let anyone discourage you when you're trying to pursue a goal or a dream. And finally, do things while you're young. Be sure to pursue your dreams and goals, even if they seem impossible. It all sounded good, but the truth was, I wasn't sure what my own goals and dreams were beyond skiing and a job as a physical therapist. I knew I wanted to go to college, but my dad had made it clear I would have to pay my own way. I dreamed of going to Dartmouth, but the Ivy League was financially out of the question. I ended up choosing the College of St. Scholastica, my mom's alma mater. It was a small, private, liberal arts school and had a highly regarded physical therapy program. Best, and worst of all, it would allow me to stay at home, to continue helping around the house. Mom's spasticity was getting worse, and Steve had stopped coming as much. There just wasn't a lot he could do anymore. When I started taking classes, it was a relief to be out of the house. That might sound like an awful thing to say, but it was the truth. Only 1 in 5 kids from Proctor attended college, so most of my friends stayed around and took jobs. I took a job, too, at the Nordic Track shop at Miller Hill Mall in Duluth. I would put on a polo shirt and demonstrate and sell Nordic Track machines. I was polite, and I knew about the movements of cross-country ski machines. Nick the Greek, who worked a few evening shifts, wanted to fix me up with his daughter. I took medieval history and chemistry and freshman composition. I ate at McDonald's at the mall at least 4 times a week. I'd get 2 McChicken sandwiches, extra-large fries, and a Coke. As a kid, I had rarely had fast food. Between my mom's dedication to cooking and my dad's dedication to saving, it was a luxury we couldn't afford. So being able to buy a burger or chicken sandwich whenever I wanted felt like freedom. And it tasted good. While salads and vegetable stir-fries might have been okay for some people, I was an athlete, and everyone said serious jocks needed serious protein. That meant meat. I ran cross-country in the fall, but only lasted about half the season. 3 meets. It was a total junk show. The baseball coach was coaching the team. We wore uniforms that the girls' team had thrown out a decade or two earlier. To stay in shape for the coming ski season, I ran on my own, or, more and more often, with Dusty. We would drive to ski races in my car, and while I would be getting gas, he would be shuffling out of the convenience store attached to the gas station with a package of bologna or potato chips in his pants. I'm surprised we never got arrested. While I drove down the freeway in my old wagon, Dusty would hang out of the passenger window and high-five fellow skiers on their way to races. He loved the all-you-can-eat buffets. He taught me how to stuff my jacket full of slices from Godfather's Pizza after our stomachs could hold no more. When Dusty wasn't stealing stuff, getting into trouble, or running, he was working at the ski hut, which sold ski gear. He would ride his bike to work, his skis strapped to his bike, in negative 15-degree weather. That guy could endure. And of course, Dusty always beat me on our runs. He was faster and stronger, and I remembered that broken ankle, would never be that tough. We both knew it. But we both knew that I was changing. Dusty skied a 90K training day every year during winter break, the week after Christmas. It was called the 90K Day. The guy who organized it was Rick Calais, the coach of St. Paul's Central High School, whom everybody called the Ricker. Only the hardest of hardcore skiers did it. The last year of high school, Dusty asked if I wanted to join him. Of course, he beat me, but afterwards he told me that he and the Ricker had been looking back every minute or so of the last 10 miles, amazed at how close I was. He knew I never had blazing speed, and he couldn't believe I was keeping up. To this day, the Ricker says, the 90K day is what made the jerker. Dusty still gave me shit about college, about what a nerd I looked like in my polo shirt at Nordic Track, about how straight I was. I envied him. I wondered what it would be like to have no responsibility, no worries. I wondered what it would be like to have his life. One night, in March of my freshman year, I came home a little later than I said I would. My dad told me that when I said I would be home at a certain time, I'd better be home then. I told him he had to realize I had a life outside the house, I was working full-time and going to school, and I had a lot going on, but he didn't want to hear it. He said, "If you don't like it here, you can go live someplace else. This is the way we do things around here." I was sure he wasn't serious about my living someplace else, but he was. He really meant it. He said, "I don't want you around here anymore." We were both yelling at each other. My mom was crying. Even when she was well, I don't know if she could have intervened. I had a chemistry test the next day, so I grabbed my books. I didn't even take any clothes, and I threw them in a bag and walked out. I drove to an overlook at a nearby rise called Thompson Hill, pulled into a rest area overlooking Duluth, and just sat there. It was freezing. I didn't think about where I was going to live, or how my life was changing. I knew what I had to do. I pulled my car below one of the rest area lights. I pulled out my chemistry book and opened it. I started studying. Chapter 6, The Wisdom of Hippie Dan, Minnesota Voyager 50, 1994. A quote from Yvon Chouinard: "The more you know, the less you need." People are always asking me the same question. Why, when I could stay in shape with a 25-minute jog, do I train for 5 hours at a time? Why, when I could run a perfectly civilized marathon, would I choose to run four of them back to back? Why, instead of gliding over shaded tracks, would I take on Death Valley in the height of the summer? Am I masochistic? Addicted to endorphins? Is there something deep down inside that I'm running from? Or am I seeking something I never had? At the beginning of college, I ran because of Dusty. It was the summer after my freshman year. Dusty was living with guys in a place they called the House of Gravity. One of his roommates was a champion downhill skier, another was a world-class mountain biker. Dusty was bunking in the attic where the temperature could drop to negative 20 degrees and slept in a down winter sleeping bag from an army surplus store. They called it the House of Gravity because they smoked from a gigantic bong so often that much of the time they couldn't get up. They decided the field of gravity was greater in that house than anywhere else. They even attached the bong to a rope so they could swing it from one person to another. Meanwhile, I was staying with the Obrechts, the family that had reformed the Proctor High School boys' ski team. To see my mom and little brother and sister, I had to sneak back to the house when I knew my dad was working. Dusty and his housemates lived day to day. I couldn't stop thinking about the future. I knew my skiing career was coming to an end. I didn't have Dusty's talent, and while I could hone my technique until a casual observer would think I was born in Norway, I had to figure out how guys like Dusty, and there were a lot of them at the upper levels of cross-country skiing, could almost always sprint faster than I could. No matter how hard I worked, I could never attain the pure speed that others could. I think whoever, or whatever, gave me determination and a good work ethic, forgot to throw in fast-twitch muscles. Then Dusty called me and told me he had won a 50-mile race called the Minnesota Voyager. He said he was going to run it next year, too, and asked whether I wanted to train with him. Of course I said yes. I always said yes to Dusty. I told myself it was to get in shape for next ski season, but in reality, Dusty was living the life I envied. Free, fun, and fast. He was a dirtbag, and I wanted to be a dirtbag too. So we dirtbags trained. We would run for 2.5 hours, Dusty giving me shit the whole way. Jerker this and jerker that, telling me I studied too hard, that I thought too much, I needed to loosen up. Who cared if I was fucking valedictorian? We picked up mud along the way and flung it at each other with various insults. Then one day, just when I was getting used to running distance, Dusty said we should mix up the training, and he threw in bike riding to the equation. My experience riding was on the hunk of metal my dad had welded for me. Dusty promised it would be fun. He persuaded a friend of his to sell me his old bike, a celeste green steel Bianchi. It was too small for me, so Dusty helped me put on an oversized mountain bike seat post. We'd go 70, 100 miles. Dusty knew how to ride, knew all the mechanics. He had raced against George Hincappy a few years earlier. Hincapie would eventually compete in the Tour de France. There I was, my giant seat post jabbing the seat into my nuts every time I hit a rock, ready to quit every 5 minutes. Except I didn't. Maybe because it was such a relief to be away from studying and the sadness of my family, from watching my mom deteriorate and sensing my dad getting sadder and more angry. I didn't have the skills, and I didn't have the bike, but I discovered something important during those rides with Dusty. I learned that even though I was a hack, even though I didn't know anything about riding, I hadn't read a single book on it, hadn't studied a single essay on spinning or gear ratios, I could gut out those long rides. I wondered what else I could gut out. I moved into the dorms my sophomore year. I signed up for a class with Sister Mary Richard Boo, who was a notorious hardass, even among the St. Scholastica hardass nuns. The first day of class, she told us to get out Crime and Punishment. We had 5 days to read it. It was a struggle between my other classes, my 30-hour-a-week Nordic track job, sneaking home to help my mom, and training for what I was sure would be my last season of cross-country skiing. I looked at my classmates, the student body was 70% female, laughing on their way to class. I didn't think many of them were on scholarship. They always seemed to have plenty of time. It seemed to me their whole life was school and intramural sports and parties. I felt out of place. It wasn't the first time. It didn't help when Dusty would come over from the House of Gravity reeking of marijuana, hair down to his shoulders, making googly eyes at the coeds. He'd say, "Hey, man," and they'd blush. They all asked me, "Who's your stoner friend?" Dusty was always a hit with the ladies. One day, he slapped a sticker on my door that read, "Thank you for pot smoking." I left it up, and the visiting students would laugh as they passed by, but I'm sure their parents didn't. If someone had asked me at the time what I liked about Dusty, I probably would have shrugged. He was my friend, and that was enough. Now, though, I suspect it was because he embodied the worldview that was pulling at me. I had started delving into existential literature in high school and was continuing in college. Writers like Sartre and Camus described the plight of the outsider who felt like a stranger in an incomprehensible world. Hermann Hesse wrote about the search for the sacred amid chaos and suffering. The existentialists did not believe in living life from the neck up. They challenged me to reject artifice and the expectations of others, to create a meaningful life. Back then, while my life never strayed from the conventional lines of socially approved behavior, the people I chose to hang out with created their own conventions. People like my uncle, my mom's younger brother nicknamed the Communist, who wore a Malcolm X cap, demonstrated to protect the rights of the homeless, slept on the beaches of Hawaii, worked on the Alaska pipeline, and usually had a copy of Mao's Little Red Book in his pocket. And people like Dusty, of course, who now had a puke-green Chevy van emblazoned with a bumper sticker that read, "Hey, mister, don't laugh. Your daughter might be in here." The most unconventional of all might have been the Minnesotan known as Hippie Dan, a modern Henry David Thoreau. Dan Proctor was 45 years old when I met him in 1992 at the co-op where he worked and which he co-owned, the Positively Third Street Bakery. He was 5'10", all legs and long, gangly arms. He wore a t-shirt that said, "Bikes, not bombs," partly hidden by a beard that would have looked at home on a Hasid. He moved as if he was dancing at a Grateful Dead concert. His hair was plaited into two braids that hung over each shoulder. He talked fast about the environment and wheatgrass juice and whole grains and living a mindful life. He spoke with a Scandinavian twang, and when he laughed, he sounded like a loon at dusk. Hippie Dan made thunder cookies that were like chocolate chip cookies on steroids, with oatmeal and whole wheat flour and peanut butter and tons of butter. They were the best cookies I ever tasted. Rumor has it, he once ran a secret bakery in the back of the shop, long since closed, and Dusty and his stoner pals used to sample those goods a lot. He was also a local running legend. People said that when he was younger, he would ride his bike to the local races. Then, wearing blue jeans, he would leave all the people wearing shorts gasping as he shot ahead of them. Even Dusty seemed in awe of Hippie Dan. Dan had been running for 20 years. He didn't have a car or a phone. Eventually, he would get rid of his refrigerator. He talked about solar energy and living off the grid and minimizing impact. He produced one small garbage can of trash over an entire year. He also talked a lot about fossil fuels and the foolishness of humans. Essentially, he was trying to lessen his impact on the Earth long before that became a trend. Some people called him the Unibaker. Once, Hippie Dan invited me to run with him. We followed his yellow labs, Zoot and Otis, and he told me to watch how effortlessly they ran. He encouraged me to notice how they seemed connected to their surroundings. Simplicity, he said. Simplicity and a connection to the land made us happy and granted us freedom. As a bonus, it made us better runners. I didn't know it, but it was a lesson I would learn years later in a hidden canyon in Mexico. I longed for happiness and freedom as much as the next guy, probably even more, considering my schoolwork and jobs and the situation at home. I could see the wisdom in a simpler is better philosophy. But simple for me had never been, well, simple. I had always tackled problems by study and focus. Consequently, when I began training with Dusty for his upcoming Voyager, I suggested we read up on race strategy and training techniques. Maybe, I said, we should do some intervals or alternate sprints and jogs. Maybe we should count our strides. I think I mentioned heart rate monitors and lactate thresholds. Dusty told me I was full of shit. He said I thought too much. Do monster distances, he said. Work your tail off, and that's what'll save your ass. He mimicked the Ricker's voice as he beamed, if you want to win, get out and train, and then train some more. So we spent that spring chugging monster distances that lasted 2, 3, 4 hours, runs all through and around Duluth. Dusty would come by and knock on my dorm door, and I'd take a break from the Brothers Karamazov or War and Peace, or upper level physics or anatomy and physiology, and we'd head out. We ran on paths that would narrow to trails, and on trails that would narrow to almost nothing. We were running where deer bounded, where coyotes rambled. We ran through calf-deep snow and streams swollen with spring melt so cold that after a while I couldn't feel my feet. Somewhere between my agonized, gasping high school forays to Adolf Store and now, running had turned into something other than training. It had turned into a kind of meditation, a place where I could let my mind, usually occupied with school, thoughts of the future, or concerns about my mom, float free. My body was doing by itself what I had always struggled to make it do. I wasn't stuck on my dead-end street. No bully was spitting in my face. I felt as if I was flying. Dusty knew all the animal paths in the area, and after that spring, I knew them too. We ran free all spring, sometimes talking, sometimes silent. We ran the way we always ran, Dusty in the lead, me behind. I knew my place, and it was fine. It was all quite fine. I know a novelist who says he was never happier than when he was working on his first book, which turned out to be so bad that he never showed the manuscript to anyone. He said his joy came from the way time stopped and from all he learned about himself and his craft during those sessions. Running with Dusty that spring, not racing, running, I understood what the writer had been talking about. I also thought I might do all right in a race. I entered Duluth's Grandma's Marathon in June, and all the training with Dusty paid off. I finished in 2 hours, 54 minutes. Not bad. I thought that with focus and training, I could get faster. Instead, with Dusty's recommendation, I decided to go farther. I would enter my first ultra. The day of the 1994 Voyager, we were both ready. And when Dusty, the defending champion, shot off at the starting line, I shot off too. Dusty didn't call me jerker or give me shit about my studies. We ran, and not just free. We ran hard. Minnesota in late July can be a muggy 90 degrees and muddy, and this day it was both of those, but we kept cranking. Then, at about mile 25, in a particularly gooey mud puddle, Dusty's left shoe came off. He stopped to fetch it, and for a second I hesitated. How was I supposed to run without Dusty in front of me? He was the legend. I was the sidekick. He was the runner. I was just a stubborn Polack. I wasn't sure what to do, so I did what I had been doing. I kept running. I ran for a few seconds, then a few minutes, and I looked back over my shoulder, and I didn't see Dusty. I kept running. Maybe my ski career was over. Maybe my dad would never be happy. Maybe my mom wasn't going to get better. And maybe I'd always lead a dual life, split between diligence and the wild ways that Dusty represented. But at the moment I crossed the finish line, it didn't matter. I had completed one of the hardest things I had ever attempted, and I told myself, never again. I lay face down in the grass, panting, happy, but feeling sick, totally drained. I didn't have anything left. Was this what being a runner meant? Putting everything into a single race until you had nothing left to give? I had sensed a long time earlier that I had a talent for gaining speed when others gave ground, and I had wondered how that talent might serve me. In the rocky hills outside Duluth, bouncing on my cruel, nut-crunching Bianchi, I had realized that no matter how much something hurt, I could gut it out. I wondered what that skill would ever be good for. I finished second in my first Voyager, beating Dusty, who finished third, for the first time. Hippie Dan had told me that we all had our own path, that the trick was to find it. I think I had found mine. Easier, not harder. Coming from the flatlands, I had to learn to run uphill. Sharpening that skill, I improved all my running. You can too, with or without hills. Next time you're running, count the times your right foot strikes the ground in 20 seconds. Multiply by 3 and you'll have your stride rate per minute. 1 stride equals 2 steps, so your steps per minute will be twice your stride rate. Now comes the good part. Speed up until you're running at 85 to 95 strides per minute. The most common mistake runners make is overstriding, taking slow, big steps, reaching far forward with the left foot, and landing on the heel. This means more time on the ground, which means the vulnerable heel hits the ground with more force on landing, creating more impact on the joints. Training at a stride rate of 85 to 90 is the quickest way to correct this problem. Short, light, quick steps will minimize impact force and keep you running longer, safer. It will also make you a more efficient runner. Studies have shown that nearly all elite runners competing at distances between 3,000 meters and marathon distances are running at 85 to 90 plus stride rates. I used to train runners with a metronome. Nowadays, there are plenty of websites that list music by BPM, beats per minute. Try cycle.jog.fm. Either 90 or 180 BPM songs will do the trick. Chapter 7. Let the pain go out your ears. Minnesota Voyager 50, 1995 and 1996. A quote from George Bernard Shaw. Always do what you are afraid to do. I met the woman who helped turn me into a vegan in line at McDonald's. She was waiting for a refill of a Diet Coke. I was picking up my lunch. Leo was blonde and smiled a lot. Because she had what seemed like a million pairs of Birkenstocks, some of the guys at the mall called her Birkenstock Girl. She worked at a clothing store and was a student at the University of Minnesota Duluth and rode her bike everywhere. And she was mostly vegetarian, which made her eating at McDonald's sort of odd, I suppose. She and I hit it off, and between Leah and Hippie Dan and some of the books he was giving me, like Wendell Berry's The Unsettling of America, about how the loss of agriculture is the loss of culture, how we've gone from knowing where our food comes from to not even thinking that the packages of chicken we buy in the grocery store come from anywhere. I was changing. I began to put Havarti cheese and spinach on my sandwiches instead of summer sausage. I cut down on breakfast sausage egg biscuits, but not much. I would make granola once in a while. I cooked brown rice and broccoli in my grandmother's Litton microwave. My mom gave it to me when I moved into my own apartment. I made the rice just as she taught me. Still, I was an athlete and a young man who felt invincible, so when I was a junior, beginning to embrace the earth-conscious sensibilities of people like Hippie Dan, I was also shoving down 2 McChicken sandwiches and a large order of fries, as well as the occasional Big Mac, at least 4 times a week. I figured I needed the protein, and that a little junk food never hurt anyone. I loved to grill, and was always cooking up sausage, steaks, bratwurst, pork chops, and whatever other animal flesh I could find, all in a giant grill I had bought at a garage sale and lugged to the apartment I shared with my pal Damon Holmes. I was the grill master. Besides, I worried that a plant-based diet would ensure round-the-clock bland food. It's not that I was totally ignorant. The brown rice had helped me carb up before a race. I had tasted the wonders of granola. The salads and other vegetables at the Team Berkey ski camp helped my endurance, and Hippie Dan had been trying to sell me on the nutritional and ecological benefits of drinking wheatgrass juice and eating more fruits and veggies. Serious student that I was, and frugal, I even planted a little wheatgrass. I promised myself to keep reading up on the whole plant-based diet thing, but in the meantime, Damon and I spent many a night on our back porch, feet on the banister, barbecued steak or burgers or brats in our midst, downing a tin of Planters cheese balls and a box of malted milk balls in a single sitting. I was occasionally hunting and fishing, and I was still committed to protein and what I thought was the fastest way to get it, through eating dead animals. I didn't want to risk running my second Voyager without it. I needn't have worried about getting enough protein. The average 19 to 30-year-old American consumes 91 grams a day, nearly twice the recommended daily amount. 56 grams for an adult male, 46 for an adult female. I wasn't aware that too much protein stresses the kidneys, an organ long-distance runners worry about in the best of times, due to our careful attention to water consumption, retention, and elimination, and can leach calcium from the bones. I didn't quite believe that you could get an adequate supply of protein, even if you're an ultra-runner, from plants. I certainly didn't think it would be easy. So, I had the occasional sausage egg biscuit, the random burger. Like it or not, I was still a Minnesota redneck, a hunter and fisherman. I was still my father's son. When Leo would show up with organic apples or milk, I would see the price tag. I went berserk. I'd yell, "You paid how much for that? What's in it, gold dust?" Leah and I saw a lot of each other in that year. I had landed a second job at a running shoe store called Austin Jero, named for Jero, who had legally gotten rid of his last name, like Madonna, and Bill Austin, both local standout runners. With my 2 jobs, and Leah, and studies, and at least 2 hours of running every day, I didn't have time for much else. I stopped visiting my mom and brother and sister very often. Even if I had wanted to, I wasn't willing to go there when my dad was home. I had often talked to Mom on the phone. She told me that Dusty called there sometimes, too, and that she was always glad to hear from him, but that Dusty had a hard time understanding her. Her vocal cords were getting weak from the MS. In the spring of 1995, my mom told me she was moving to a nursing home. She had decided it would be better that way. As angry as I had been at my father, it was nothing compared to how I felt when she delivered that news. How could he let this happen? A nursing home? She was only 44. What if I had never left? Could I have prevented this? Again, I had questions for which there were no answers. She told me it was for the best, that I shouldn't worry, that I should study hard, that everything would be okay. So I studied hard and ran harder. Dusty noticed. I was tearing up ground. I was assaulting hills and attacking animal trails. The more weed choked, the better. I ran the game trails Dusty had shown me, and across rivers. I ran through rain and snow and blistering heat. Now I was the one in front, and Dusty was right behind me. He kept saying the same thing over and over. "Let the pain go out your ears, jerker. Let the pain go out your ears." I didn't, though. I held on to the pain. In my second Minnesota Voyager, I made the pain mine. I used it. All through the 50 miles of the race, I listened to it. You could have done more. You can do more. Sometimes you just do things. I ran away from the pain, but it seemed as if I was running toward it. I thought of my mom, crippled. I thought of my life, my ridiculous, petty worries. I thought of the distances I had gone, all the work I had done. I didn't even have to ask myself the question. It was part of me now. Why? I shot off the starting line. Just me this time, no Dusty. And I swallowed that course. I had never run harder. I finished in second place again. Somehow, I would have to run faster, but I couldn't run harder. What was the secret? A sick old man told me a part of it. He had just shuffled back from his physical therapy session and was slowly climbing back into his hospital bed. With each painful step he took, I could see his frustration, feel his anger. It was my senior year at St. Scholastica, which doubled as my first year in physical therapy school. As part of my training, I was an intern at a hospital in Ashland, Wisconsin. I was supposed to be helping this old man, and we both knew I was failing. He climbed into bed and looked at the lunch tray waiting for him. Salisbury steak, drenched in something brown and congealed, instant potatoes, iridescent-looking canned peas. His expression said it might as well have been a tray of rocks. He didn't say anything, but it was as though he was shouting. That's when I heard part of the secret. What we eat is a matter of life and death. Food is who we are. I had listened to Hippie Dan. I had remembered my grandmother showing me how good carrots pulled fresh out of the garden tasted. I knew that cutting down on meat and sugar was better for me. But watching a frail, sick man look at his lunch with a cross between nausea and indifference made me think of something else. The food they served at the nursing home where my mother was bedridden was processed, filled with starches and sugars. The meals my client ate at hospitals were heavy on meat, low on vegetables. As an athlete, I was ostensibly dedicated to health. As a physical therapist, I was supposed to be helping people with their bodies, but I didn't spend a second focusing on their diet. The healthier I had eaten, the faster and stronger I had become. Was it a coincidence that sick people were being served starchy, crappy food? If a balanced diet could make someone faster, could a bad diet make someone sick? The answer, I discovered, was yes. I'd learned that diabetes now affects nearly 10% of Americans, and that type 2 diabetes, once nearly unheard of in children, is on the rise, bringing with it a host of complications such as kidney failure, blindness, and amputations, not to mention increased chances of stroke and heart disease in adults. The three most common causes of death in our country, heart disease, cancer, and stroke, have all been linked to the standard Western diet, rich in animal products, refined carbohydrates, and processed foods. Another part of the secret was revealed to me when I did a second internship the next spring in Albuquerque, New Mexico. I was shopping in a grocery store, possibly even getting a steak, waiting in the checkout line when I picked up a magazine to pass the time. There was an article about a doctor named Andrew Weil and one of his books, Spontaneous Healing. He said the human body possessed an enormous capacity to take care of itself as long as we took care of it by feeding it well and not putting toxins in it. Shortly after, I sought out that book and devoured it, cover to cover. Neither my reading nor the old man's lunch marked a come-to-Jesus moment for me, but they did open my eyes to the benefits and importance of a plant-based diet. I didn't realize it then, but that spring marked the beginning of my lifelong commitment to learning about food, to eating better, and to living more consciously. Cutting out processed foods and refined carbohydrates was not difficult. I had grown up eating bread my grandmother baked and fish my dad had caught. Meat and dairy were other matters. I didn't want to consume either because of the stress to my kidneys, possible loss of calcium, increased chances of prostate cancer, stroke, and heart disease, not to mention the chemicals and hormones injected into the country's food supply and the environmental degradation caused by cattle farms. But I was racing now, not just running with Dusty for kicks, so I was even more conscious that I still needed fuel to burn. I knew I had to figure out a way to get enough protein, to marry my healthy eating with my long-distance running. Combining vegetarian protein sources like legumes and grains every meal, until recently, an article of faith among vegetarians, seemed too labor-intensive. And it might have been. But I learned that our bodies pool the amino acids from the foods we eat over the course of the day. I didn't have to sit down and do the math every time I ate. As long as I ate a varied whole foods diet with adequate caloric intake, I would get enough complete protein. Even the Conservative American Dietetic Association, the largest organization of dietary professionals in the world, has stated in no uncertain terms, appropriately planned vegetarian diets, including total vegetarian or vegan diets, are healthful, nutritionally adequate, and may provide health benefits in the prevention and treatment of certain diseases. Well-planned vegetarian diets are appropriate for individuals during all stages of the life cycle, including pregnancy, lactation, infancy, childhood, and adolescence, and for athletes. Those last two words were music to an almost vegetarian ultra-runner's ears. The next summer, I won the Voyager on my third try, eating more plants and less meat. I didn't run harder. I had been right. I couldn't run harder. But I had learned something important. I could run smarter. I could eat smarter. I could live smarter. I knew I could keep going when others stopped. I knew I had good legs and good lungs. I wasn't just a runner now. I was a racer. And I was a mindful eater. How many races could I win with my newfound secret? I aimed to find out. Landing zone. In an ideal world, all runners would land on their forefoot or midfoot when they run. In an ideal world, though, all runners would be lean, healthy, and have spent most of their lives clocking 5-minute miles. There's no question that forefoot striking is more efficient than heel striking. It uses the elasticity of the Achilles tendon and the arch of the foot to translate the body's downward force into forward motion. Less energy is lost to the ground. It is also a given that landing on the forefoot, as barefoot runners do, prevents the heel striking that cushioned shoes enable, which can lead to so many joint and tendon injuries. But it's also true that it's not a perfect world. Beginners run. Out-of-shape people run. And for them, forefoot striking might increase the risk of tendonitis or other soft tissue injury. That's especially true for anyone who hasn't grown up running barefoot through rural Kenya. Most researchers would say that a midfoot landing is the most efficient and shock-absorbing technique, but there are people who fall on both ends of the spectrum. Heel strikers and those who run on the balls of their feet, and they do fine. What's important isn't what part of the foot you strike, but where it strikes. It should land slightly in front of your center mass or right underneath it. When you have a high stride rate and you land with your body centered over the foot, you won't be slamming down hard, even if you connect with the heel. Chapter 8, Attack of the Big Birds, Angeles Crest 100, 1998. A quote from Mahatma Gandhi. Strength does not come from physical capacity. It comes from indomitable will. Dusty was screaming at me in Spanish. It felt as if I had stepped into a familiar nightmare. I was tired and sore, trying to will myself up a mountain trail at 7,000 feet. Dusty was already there, on the ridge, and he was hurling insults my way, just as he had hurled them at me for so many years in Minnesota. But it wasn't a nightmare. And why Spanish? My dad and I had started talking again. No big hugging, I'm so sorry now I see what's important moment. We weren't those kind of people. Leah and I had gotten married at her folks' house on August 17th, 1996, just west of Duluth, and my dad brought my mom from the nursing home. Dusty was there too, wearing a black suit and tie printed with a reproduction of the Sistine Chapel ceiling. He called it his going to court outfit. Dusty and my dad were both pissed that I was getting married and there was no alcohol, so they went back to my dad's place and drank Milwaukee's best. Soon after that, my folks divorced. I found out later it was my mom's idea to move to the home and her idea to divorce. She didn't want to be a burden. I was starting my second and final year of physical therapy training, still skiing, but just for fun and to keep in shape for running, and still eating meat 4 or 5 times a week. I was making clam chowder and grilling chicken and pork chops. I was dipping into a few of the less crazy-sounding recipes from the Moosewood cookbook, but I was still an animal protein athlete. And then, another epiphany hit me. This time, it came in a giant bowl of chili. It was December, a cold